move to the last case that will be argued today, Phylos Technologies against Phylos, and D, appeal number 10-2854. We'll hear first from Mr. Johnstone.
Good morning. May it please the Court, my name is Andrew Johnstone, and I represent the appellants Phylos and D, Don He Park and Jay He Park. We are appealing the denial of appellants' Rule 60b-4 motion to vacate the default judgment. The district court's denial of that motion to vacate was erroneous because the default judgment was void for lack of personal jurisdiction. It's critical, or it's important in this case, to recognize that there is only a claim of specific jurisdiction, not general jurisdiction. And that specific jurisdiction arises out of the sole claim in the lawsuit, which is for alleged conversion of equipment. Now, my clients obtained that equipment pursuant to a written contract that they executed with PLS Tech Korea, a Korean company that's not a party to this case. And as a result, you have two Korean companies negotiating in Korea, signing an agreement in Korea, which is was written in Korean.
Mr. Johnstone, we know you've got an argument on the merits, if we're ever to get to that. As I understand this, the Korean court was about to enforce the judgment in Korea, right?
That is what prompted us to move to vacate the default judgment.
Why was the Korean court ready to enforce this? Did it consider the jurisdictional problems in the United States?
To be honest, Your Honor, that's not part of the record. I am sure that there was an argument that was made that there wasn't a proper basis for jurisdiction in the United States for that order, but it's not part of the record exactly what the arguments were or that were made in Korea. But clearly, we were concerned about the possibility that the judgment would be executed against our clients, and that's what prompted us to move to vacate. It's my understanding that, at least as of today, the judgment has not yet been executed, although clearly we were very concerned. In fact, we moved for expedited treatment of this appeal because we were concerned that the judgment could be executed at any time.
Well, okay. As I understand this area of the law, somebody in your client's position, whether you're in different countries or in different states in the United States, has the option of just sitting back and challenging jurisdiction of the rendering court, the original court, when there's an attempt made to enforce that judgment.
Absolutely, Your Honor. In fact, that's our position, that there was no obligation for us to appear in the first instance to contest jurisdiction or oppose the motion for default judgment. But I would submit that once a judgment has been entered and once the other side is taking steps to actually enforce it, it's a prudent litigant who doesn't put all his eggs in one basket.
You got to pick one or the other, don't you?
I don't know. I think we are within our rights to contest enforcement of the judgment in Korea and also come to the court here in the United States and point out that there was a lack of jurisdiction and seek to have that default judgment vacated. Again, I think it would be only prudent to try and pursue both courses.
Let's put it this way. I think it's pretty clear that you're not entitled to get two separate decisions on that question. You've got to litigate it to a conclusion in one or the other.
To be honest, I haven't looked closely at that issue, Your Honor, but I would submit that I don't know. I'm not familiar with Korean law. Korean law may have standards about what is an appropriate judgment that are not exactly in harmony with the standards under the U.S. Constitution or under Illinois law. So I'm hesitant to say that they're exactly the same. It's quite possible that the Korean courts have either a lesser or more stringent standard for what is an appropriate exercise of jurisdiction by a foreign court.
In terms of the merits of the jurisdictional problem, I'll tell you my impression so far is that if that issue is open for full litigation at this point, we've got conflicting evidence from the affidavits about what your clients were doing on a visit to Chicago and how connected it was with the transaction and so on. So it would seem that a full decision on the merits of that would seem to require an evidentiary hearing.
Well, if I can address your question in two parts, Your Honor. First of all, we would submit that the critical facts necessary for jurisdiction are not in dispute. It's not disputed that there was a written contract governing the delivery of this equipment to my clients and that everything associated with that written contract was in Korea. There's a contention that there was an oral modification or oral amendment of that contract, but it's our position that the Korean contract that was executed in December of 2007 contains an integration clause and says it can only be modified in writing. So the purported oral modification understanding, it's just not effective. And under the RAR case, RAR versus Turner Diesel, you have to look at the specific contacts with the jurisdiction arising out of the claim, out of the transaction. In that case, there were a whole host of other contacts by the defendant that didn't relate to the specific transaction that was issue in that case. And the court said, we don't look to those. When you're talking about an issue of specific jurisdiction, you look at just the contacts arising out of the transaction. And here we've got alleged conversion of equipment from a contract, and everything about that is having to do with Korea, not the United States. The only thing that concerns the United States is the place of manufacture, which under the Ferris case is not relevant. But to get to the second part of your question, Your Honor, which is, do we require an evidentiary hearing? If you conclude that there is a disputed factual issue that's critical or significant to the issue of jurisdiction, then yes, remand is appropriate because it's clear that the district court didn't address the merits of the motion to vacate. What he did was he said, I already fully litigated this at the default judgment standpoint, and it's too late for you to bring this. Well, first of all, the position that it's too late to bring that, that's clearly erroneous. Under this court's rulings, you can bring a motion to vacate a default judgment that's void for lack of personal jurisdiction at any time. There's no time limit for that. And then secondly, this idea that it was fully litigated at the default judgment context or at that time, I mean, that was on the basis of a one-sided presentation with my clients absent, and the district court simply rubber-stamped an order that was submitted by the plaintiffs.
What are we to make of this letter that the two Mr. Parks and the company sent to the district court?
Well, Your Honor, you have to understand the context. These are two Korean litigants with limited understanding of English, no familiarity with U.S. legal system. They were surprised and confused to be sued by Phylos Technologies over equipment that they had obtained pursuant to a contract with a Korean company, especially when there's in that contract a forum selection clause that specifies disputes are going to be litigated in Korea. They didn't file an appearance in the case. They didn't file a responsive pleading. They didn't participate in discovery. All they did was send a one-page letter expressing surprise and confusion. That falls far short of the cases that the appellee cites, which require much more extensive participation in litigation to find any sort of waiver.
Well, the first issue, though, was the letter. I mean, that was the, whatever you want to call it, appearance or answer or something.
Well, it's clearly not an answer.
Well,
it's just,
I know, but there was nothing since then. I guess that's the only problem I have, is with all the things that were going on, I understand your clients were getting served with that or copies or something. Is that a dispute?
I'm not sure I understand your question, but let me try.
Well, no, but weren't they kept appraised of what's going on?
Yes, absolutely. They were notified by about the pending motion for default and that the default had been entered. But I would submit, Your Honor, that the issue of the response letter and then the notice issue, those are separate issues. You have to consider, is the response letter actually a formal appearance, formal participation, such that it waives objections to personal jurisdiction first?
Let's slice that a little more finely, okay? It's not a waiver of personal jurisdiction, clearly, but the question is whether it is a de facto consent to have the issue of jurisdiction litigated in the Chicago court, in the Illinois court.
Well, I would submit, Your Honor, that
just sitting back, as you're entitled to do,
right,
and wait for somebody to try to enforce it.
I would submit that there's not much authority on this issue of sending letters to the court, but what authority there is suggests that sending a letter like this doesn't waive jurisdiction or doesn't consent to jurisdiction being decided.
Special appearance under Illinois law.
Are you asking, does it require one?
No, I mean, is it a special appearance from the point of view of contesting jurisdiction under Illinois law?
Well, Your Honor, I'm not sure that it goes so far as to constitute a special appearance. Once again, these are Koreans operating pro se, not understanding the U.S. legal system. To expect them to understand the intricacies of a special appearance without waiving jurisdiction, I think, is a lot to ask of a foreign litigant. If the situation were reversed and you had a U.S. company being sued in China, I can understand similar confusion.
The default judgment said something about jurisdiction, and there is, seems to me, his principal reliance was upon his letter.
Absolutely, Your Honor.
Right?
Agreed. The default judgment.
Earlier, he talked about the timing problem, the delay.
Right.
But then, when he got around to the default, Of course, that was just something that was furnished him by the...
Absolutely, Your Honor. If you look at what was...
He went along and said, well, that was a waiver of objection to the jurisdiction, I think.
I think I agree with Your Honor. I think that was an argument that was come up with by plaintiff's counsel and incorporated into their proposed order, and the judge just entered it. I see that I've reached the end of my time. I'm happy to answer your question, but I'd like to reserve some time for rebuttal.
I'll give you a couple extra minutes for rebuttal, but let me ask you. Let's go back to Judge Cudahy has asked the question in a more precise way than I did about the legal effect of the letter. And give us your best authority for not treating that as the equivalent of a special appearance, which effectively consented to litigating the jurisdiction issue in Illinois.
Well, I would say that the best authority that I have is probably
doesn't have to be just one.
Well, the best authority that I have is probably the district court case from Georgia, which I'll consult my papers and I'll supply that in rebuttal if I can, Your Honor. I apologize. I'd like to reserve the balance of my time for rebuttal.
No time left, but we'll give you 2 minutes for rebuttal. Just plan on that. Okay. Let's see. Mr. Vickers for the plaintiffs. Good morning.
May it please the Court, Tom Vickers on behalf of the plaintiff, Philos Technologies. There are some facts that clearly aren't disputed here, Your Honors. There's no dispute at all that the defendants were properly served. There's no dispute at all that they submitted a response letter. In that response letter, which we've never argued, by the way, constituted waiver, they clearly raise jurisdiction. They might not, because they are pro se litigants, have called it a special and limited appearance. But in that letter, they said, we've had nothing to do with these plaintiffs in Illinois, this plaintiff in Illinois, dismissed the lawsuit. Now, after they did hire lawyers in the U.S. for purposes of filing the motion to vacate, the defendants argued to the district court that the response letter was intended as an objection to personal jurisdiction. That's in their motion to vacate, document number 33, page 11. So it's exactly what that was. They asserted an objection. We served them with everything. They requested time. They said, please continue the status so we can get lawyers. We gave them the time. We brought a motion for them. We said they want to obtain counsel. We didn't just tender to Judge Hibbler an order and say sign. When we filed the motion for the default, we submitted affidavits and documentary evidence to establish not only liability and damages, but also personal jurisdiction. Mr. Coe's affidavit detailed all of the contacts he had with the defendants at his facility in Wheeling, the negotiations that took place at the facility in Wheeling, the whole issue with the direct foreign investment, the fact that the defendants ultimately filed for tax benefits from the Korean government based on the direct foreign investment, and they can't have a direct foreign investment in Korea, Your Honors, unless they have a foreign investor. That foreign investor was Philos Technologies, the Illinois company. All of this factual evidence was presented to Judge Hibbler. We appeared for the default hearing. I had the affiant with me. I said, Your Honor, we're happy to put Mr. Coe on the stand if you have some questions for him. He said, read everything over. I have no questions. I'll enter the order. Every step of the way, the defendants were provided every opportunity to participate.
Well, the only trouble with that theory is that the judge originally said that you couldn't bring a 60B4 motion because you should have done this by appeal, and that was, I think, clearly wrong on his part.
Well,
so we don't know whether he was still relying on that or whether he was relying on the letter. The letter is mentioned in this subsequent order, but I'm not sure what his rationale was.
It's correct, Your Honor, that Judge Hibbler didn't prepare a detailed written order with all his findings from the motion to vacate.
Well,
however,
care about that.
What
I
he did say,
had
though,
relied on this timeliness business, and that was just off base, I think.
Well, he did more than that, Your Honor. He said, "I think this is too late." However, even considering it, I find
well,
that I did
a
have
lot of case law that says you don't have a time limit when you're challenging an order is void.
Well, we've put forth in our brief, Your Honor, we do believe, based on Bell and Teiching, that the court would be within its authority to say, in this factual circumstance, where the defendant, did in fact acknowledge the service, did participate, put themselves before the court to challenge the jurisdictional issue, there is a timeliness issue. They could have filed a Rule 59 motion. They could have filed a direct appeal.
That all depends on the letter, right? Because you can serve them to a fare-thee-well, and they're entitled to sit back and wait and challenge it later. They don't have to appeal. They don't have to file a Rule 59 motion. Your entire argument depends upon treating the single letter as the equivalent of a special appearance, right?
We're treating that as a special appearance,
okay,
and the additional...
What's your best authority for holding foreign pro se litigants? A corporation, one of them is a corporation, it's got to have a lawyer to appear, and it didn't. What's your best authority for treating that sole letter under those circumstances as a consent to allow the Illinois court here to decide the issue of personal jurisdiction?
Well, I would cite the Bell case, Your Honor, and the U.S. v. Teiching case, which is a Seventh Circuit opinion that's detailed.
Does it have anything to do with personal jurisdiction?
It has to do with 60B4 challenge that was based on subject matter jurisdiction. And
that's different.
Well, it is different. And, in fact, plaintiff would submit that subject matter jurisdiction, because it's something that the parties can't consent to or waive and requires an independent assessment by the court, is even a higher standard. And the issue of timeliness, and, Your Honor, the very first thing you said, you hit on it. It was literally the day before the hearing that was going to occur to enter the enforcement order that they filed their motion to vacate. They then presented that to the court in Korea and said, we're still working on it in the U.S., we're challenging it, so the Korean court stopped. However, the Korean court did, and as a timing issue why it's not in the record at the trial court now before Your Honors, the Korean court did, in fact, consider, analyze, accept evidence to make a determination of whether the U.S. court, it felt, properly had jurisdiction. And the court in Korea found that it did. So an enforcement order has now been entered. It hasn't been executed yet, Your Honor.
But you're not raising a res judicata argument here.
Well, no, because it's a court in Korea, and I'm not raising res judicata. It's going to a question you asked, Your Honor, earlier.
Well, I know, but are you telling me that we ought to be litigating this issue in both the United States and Korea?
Not at all. When we went to do the enforcement in Korea, as courts in the U.S. do, the court said, we need to first satisfy ourselves that judgment was properly entered. And part of that analysis was, do we think, based on, we'll look at everything, we're not a U.S. court, but do we think that the U.S. court properly exercised jurisdiction? And that was a finding the Korean court said, yes, we think it did. So therefore, we will enforce this judgment. Just like if I got a judgment here, Your Honor, and I went to a district court in California, that's an initial assessment that a court would undertake. Now, getting to the merits, if the motion was timely, certainly there was sufficient facts to support Judge Hibbler's finding. Teiching is very clear on this, Your Honor, under a Rule 60B4 motion, that the standard of review, it has to be an egregious error by the court. There was no error by Judge Hibbler in his finding of personal jurisdiction. There was certainly sufficient facts presented originally to him and supplementally. Basic facts that have never been denied is that Mr. Park came to the U.S. that while he was here, they say he didn't negotiate. We have an affidavit to say he did negotiate the price, select the equipment. That's supported by the fact that ultimately they did file for the foreign direct investment credits. They can't file for those credits, Your Honor, unless they have a foreign investor. The foreign investor is Philos Technologies in Wheeling, Illinois. What Philos invested, the asset it provided, was the equipment. The problem is the defendants never recognized the value of that equipment. They never recognized their stock ownership in the company. And despite repeated requests, they refused to pay for or return the equipment. That's why we filed a conversion action. This plaintiff, Phenolis Technologies, has never said it was a party to the provisional agreement. It has always argued, and it's what's alleged in the complaint, is that when the parties met in 07, they said, we're going to do this provisional agreement, but you know what? Jehe Park said, I have an idea. If we can make this a foreign investment, so not use PLS Tech Korea, but a foreign entity to invest in this new company, we can get tax benefits. That's what brought him to Wheeling. Mr. Park admits that in the radio interview. That's why he came to Wheeling. There was clearly contact in the Illinois.
So why isn't this an oral contract claim?
Well, we could have perhaps pled an oral contract, Your Honor. We pled a conversion because they had our equipment. They didn't pay for it. We demanded it back. They refused to produce it. It's a conversion claim. See my...
Your time's not up yet.
Mm-hmm. Almost up. So, Your Honor, the record that was before Judge Hibbler, and certainly the record, the factual record before this court, supports a finding of personal jurisdiction against the defendants. And the standard of review for this court's assessment of whether Judge Hibbler properly exercised his jurisdiction, as detailed in the U.S. v. Teichin case, is that the defendants have to establish that there was egregious error on the part of Judge Hibbler. There clearly wasn't. We don't believe there was error, let alone egregious error. There's evidence put forth by the way of affidavits and documentary evidence to establish the defendant's contacts in Illinois.
Well, are you saying that you think he was correct when he said you couldn't bring a 60B at this point in time?
Your Honor, we have argued. In fact, we do think he was correct to say it was untimely. Yes, we do, Your Honor. We also, though, say if the court is going to entertain the motion, as Judge Hibbler did, he didn't just say, I'm done. He considered the factual record and found, I still believe, based on my review of the factual record, that I have jurisdiction. So he did go that extra step in considering the 60B4 motion. He didn't have a written order. We'll acknowledge that. But he did say on the record, assessing the facts, I still find that I had jurisdiction. Now I see my time is up. If Your Honors have nothing further, we ask that the district court's judgment be affirmed.
Thank you, Mr. Vickers. Rebuttal, Mr. Johnstone.
Thank you, Your Honor, and I appreciate the indulgence, so I'll be brief. I just want to address a couple of key points. First, you asked for the authority that a letter like this doesn't constitute an appearance that waives jurisdiction. I would point you to Caribbean S Corp. It's 1981 Westlaw 380692, where the court was dealing with a similar letter that had been sent to the court, and it said that was not a waiver of jurisdiction. It wasn't a general appearance or anything like that. The plaintiff's appellee cites Bell and Tityoung cases as support for their argument that the letter did constitute some sort of a waiver and appearance, but those cases have nothing to do with that issue. That issue was not in either of those cases. Another issue that was raised in the appellee's argument is Judge Hibbler's ruling. It's clear that Judge Hibbler relied on the response letter as a basis for entering default judgment. That's the only specific piece of evidence that's mentioned in the order. It doesn't talk about any supposed factual submissions that were made in the context of the motion to default judgment. He clearly relied on that letter in entering default. The plaintiff appellee claims that the standard is egregious error to the extent Judge Hibbler actually reached the factual issue of jurisdiction. That's not correct. He cites the Tityoung case again. That was a subject matter jurisdiction case where the underlying case had been litigated for 11 years, and there was no objection or contention that there was a lack of subject matter jurisdiction. And then in the context of a Rule 60B4 motion, for the first time, a subject matter jurisdiction argument was made. The court said you can never waive a subject matter jurisdiction objection. The only time you can raise it is if there was egregious error. It's a subject matter jurisdiction case that's not remotely on point either factually or legally to this case. And finally, I would say on the timeliness issue, once again, he cites the Bell and the Tityoung cases. I would submit that neither one of those cases bear on the timing issue. And so accordingly, we ask that this court reverse the court below, vacate the default judgment, and dismiss the action. Alternatively, to the extent the court thinks there are disputed factual issues that bear on the issue of jurisdiction, we believe the appropriate result is to remand for an actual hearing on those issues for Judge Hibbler to consider them in the first instance. And I'd say on that point, if you take a look at the transcript of the argument on the motion to vacate, it's clear that Judge Hibbler didn't undertake any sort of analysis of the evidence. And if he did, he didn't memorialize those findings as required by Circuit Rule 50.
Thank you, Mr. Johnstone.
Thank you.
The case will be taken under advisement. The sixth case that was on the calendar for today has had the oral argument vacated and will be considered on the briefs. The court will be in recess until, I believe, Monday. Mm-hmm.